Well, Christmas is coming, and let's face it, December can be a strange month when it comes to our diets. Weeks of austerity to fit into that party dress or festive outfit, followed by days of eating, drinking, snacking, leftovers, tins of celebrations and roses, boxes of biscuits, you know the deal. A festive orgy, followed by feelings of guilt when January comes around. So today we're asking, can you enjoy Christmas and still feel good afterwards? It's News Talk Daily. I'm Tara Duggan. Now, there's something about Christmas that turns a single day of indulgence into a month-long festival of why nots. The big dinner isn't the only culprit, it's everything around it. The office sweets, the nights out, the snacks you don't even remember putting in your gob. Most of us want to enjoy the season without guilt, without restriction, and without ending up exhausted, bloated or sluggish when the new year kicks in. The reality is, though, that food and drink hit differently at this time of year. The routines slip, the movement drops, and sleep gets knocked sideways. So today on News Talk Daily, we want some clarity. We want to know how you can enjoy the good stuff. Don't deprive yourself, but without feeling awful afterwards. With me today is someone who cuts through the noise with actual science and experience, registered dietitian and physiologist Orla Walsh. Orla, you're very welcome to News Talk Daily.
Thanks for having me on. I'm usually wheeled out of this time of year as a food police Scrooge, the food Scrooge. So it's nice to have a topic that is a bit more impactful and not making me just count the calories.
And positive as well. Because look, here's the thing. None of us want to be that person who strictly sticks to the regime all year round, who ruins Christmas for themselves and sometimes others around them by being so puritanical and being the Grinch over food and what we consume. We all want to enjoy ourselves. But let's talk about the weeks leading up. How important are they to be able to let go a little bit?
Well, it's important to realise how many weeks there are leading up to Christmas now. It's getting earlier and earlier, and we're seeing the Christmas foods in the shops as soon as Halloween is over and sometimes before then. So it's taking up a good percentage of the year, nearly a quarter of the year in some cases. So we have to be a bit tactical in how we approach Christmas and when we press the green button in terms of go and now's the time to enjoy the festivities. I would say it's the perfect time of year to practice an element of balance, because if you go into this season with an element of balance, you'll fly it in January and you can, I suppose, put the blinkers on and don't listen to the noise about the new year and new you stuff, and deprivation feels real in January. So creating an element of balance going into this season, I think it's one of the best gifts you can give yourself.
And you mentioned balance rather than restriction, because I mentioned in the intro, you know, a lot of people will cut back a little bit in November. They'll be thinking about trying to squeeze into that dress or that pair of trousers so that they look and feel good at Christmas. So is it a case for some, and indeed for many, that they restrict themselves so much in the weeks and months beforehand that by the time they get to December, it's like all bets are off and they feel that they've deprived themselves and so it's time to go hell for leather?
Exactly. It's like a person's reaction to dry November, that December becomes extremely wet. What I would say to people is, when it comes to making new habits, you have to understand the very basics of neuroplasticity. Now, that sounds like I'm about to say something super complicated, but I promise I haven't. If you picture a field with long grass and you walk across it, the path forms. And every day you walk across it, the path forms and becomes clearer and clearer and clearer. And every day you're walking across a new path, you're not walking across the old path. So that starts to grow over. And that's what happens when we make new habits. Now, when it comes to making meaningful change and sustainable change, dietitians have always encouraged people to do small steps at one time. And how I'd liken that is, simply, we only have so much motivation at any one time, and that changes across the year. So I suppose you might remember when you were younger and you would go into a shop and you have 10p and you go, how much can I get for this? And you'd put out your hand, and
clearly
it was the job of the shop assistant to actually get you as many little sweets as possible for that 10p. And when it comes to our motivation, that's how we need to look at it. So if you're coming in and you don't have much motivation on your hand, if you make sure that you're just creating one path and all the motivation you have goes to creating one new path and not several new paths, you've more chance of building that new path, walking it every day and making it concrete. So it's really important to be tactical. And when you're thinking about, well, what new path am I going to create? What new habit? I'd always go for the low-hanging fruit. What currently is the easiest thing for you to do?
So it could be something as simple as I'm going to commit to trying to get out to have a walk for 10 minutes every day of the week, or to do that even for 3 days of the week.
When it comes to making physical activity changes, we know that frequency is the most important thing. So how frequently are you doing something? And so I would encourage people, when you're making a new habit with regards to exercise, don't worry about intensity. Don't worry about volume or the time you spend doing it. Work on the frequency. So if you do 5 minutes of a walk every single day, that actually has more benefit to your body than doing 35 minutes on one day. And once you have the habit of doing 5 minutes, it's easier to make that 10 minutes than it is to do 35 minutes twice a week.
And then there are people, I think, can lose track, because if they don't do it on one day, whether that's they want to, say, make a small step and create that pathway, as you suggested, maybe their method of doing that is to just have a healthier breakfast and just leave it at that. But then the day will come and the breakfast roll will, you'll sniff the breakfast roll in the air and you'll fall off, in inverted commas, that wagon. And then you have the guilt, the shame, the, oh, geez, I've done that now. I may as well, oh, look, doesn't matter now. I may as well have a burger for lunch.
Well, I'd pull them back to that analogy of the grass and that field. And just because you walked the other path one day, it doesn't mean the new path has grown over completely. But I suppose how much that grass is trampled down with each walking across that field depends on how much feedback you are getting from your new habit. So if it's something like eating chocolate every day, there's so much feedback. Chocolate is absolutely delicious. So instead of walking across the field, it nearly feels like you're driving across it. You're creating so much of a path from that one thing. And I suppose what I'd encourage people to do is realize these points and remember that you have to be patient. If you want to create a new habit, it has to be done patiently. The more patient you are, the more chance you are going to have for success. So just because you had the chicken fillet roll one day doesn't mean the new habit is completely gone, that the grass is completely grown over. Similarly, when it comes to the healthy habits, sometimes the feedback isn't as instant and as great. So sometimes we feel like that we're not making as much headway, and it's easier to create unhealthy habits than it is for the more healthy stuff. So I'd encourage people to remember that, be practical, be patient. And really, the people who are destined for success are the people who aren't going, where will I be in a week's time or in a month's time? They're actually going, where do I want to be this time next year? And when you have that attitude to it, it just changes everything. And then patience can become so much easier to attain.
For anyone listening to this podcast today who maybe has had something of a dry November, let's say, and has been trying to rein it in, but they're at the point now, they're at that tipping point now where they're feeling this is going to go the other way. Sure, now it's time to kick up the heels and get stuck in. It's party season. What's your one piece of advice that people can be mindful of now, and a habit that they can maybe change now today, that will see them in better stead in the days after Christmas than if they did nothing?
Well, I would encourage people to actually acknowledge what they really like. So the amount of people I've said, okay, my task for you is to ask yourself, how much do I want this before you eat or drink anything? And when you're eating or drinking it, how much am I enjoying it? And when you start doing that, when you don't really want something, you'll acknowledge it before you eat it. And sometimes you'll go, actually, I'm not going to eat it. But other times you might really want it. But as soon as you're eating it, you realize, I'm not actually enjoying this as much as I thought. I had someone do it this week in clinic, and they came back in and they said, Orla, I was shocked to find I actually don't like mince pies. I thought I loved them. And every year they were having, you know, nearly a mince pie a day in the lead up of Christmas. And I said, okay, so what do you prefer? And they had a different dessert that they much preferred. When we're only eating the stuff that we really enjoy, there's so much more feedback from it. And when there's so much more feedback, we don't need as much as when we're eating lots of things we don't actually really like. So I'd encourage people to tap into it, figure out what they really, really enjoy, and focus their eyes for treats on those things, because we want to maximize enjoyment at this time of year.
How much does the language around this matter? You think of things like sins versus wins, the guilt, as I discussed, that's involved sometimes if somebody's trying to be good versus bad.
There's an emotional connection with food, and in some ways that is to be expected. Food has been very comforting since the first day we were born, and that's normal and natural. I suppose the problem comes when it's the only thing to comfort us. And food is an emotional topic for other people, but I would say no matter where you are with your relationship with food, you can get healthier with it. You can reframe it. And language is part of that. How you talk to yourself is really, really important. And it's important if you have little ones at home who are picking up on this. They don't need that language around food. And it's hard to manage all of it because even I do my best efforts at home and I would mess up sometimes. Or there's people around my kids saying horrendous things about food. I think to look at food as something that nourishes us and something that we can enjoy and to accept that, but try and maximize it so that we're getting maximal enjoyment from food. But also understand how it feels when we overindulge. How are we actually feeling in that time? Because people also go, oh, you're a dietitian, you're probably going to tell me not to overeat at Christmas time. And I always go back to them and I said, oh, and does it feel good overeating? And how do you feel overeating? Do you feel physically well? Do you feel mentally well? Do you feel socially well? Like if you overindulge at one of your dinners or and the lads text you and say, come on for pints in the pub, are you dying to go? Are you dying to open the top button of your jeans? So we have to acknowledge as well what overindulging feels like from a health point of view. And from a health point of view, we always have to think mental health, physical health, social health.
Let's talk about some of the fads, because there are so many of them and there have been. I'm old enough to remember things like the cabbage soup.
I was going to say the cabbage soup.
I remember in the 70s, clearly neighbours, you know, the women that would have been in my mum's house talking about having to have a grapefruit for breakfast because apparently it ate your fat. There's always a fad or two. You know, we've had Atkins being another one of them. At the moment, it seems to me that it's intermittent fasting. It's everywhere. Everyone's doing intermittent fasting or recommending intermittent fasting or suggesting that you should be doing it yourself. What's your view on it?
Well, firstly, there's so many different definitions of intermittent fasting. Some people come in to me and they go, I've been doing intermittent fasting for the last 6 months and I feel great. My blood results come back and they're excellent. And I go, okay, so what are you doing? Well, I don't eat after dinner. So they don't eat after 7 p.m. So they have a 12-hour fast every day. So 7 p.m. to 7 a.m. And from my point of view, that's just good, healthy practice.
Normal
and
eating.
That's what was normal eating. If you were to ask your granny or grandpa what normal eating looked like, that is normal eating to them. And I do feel that there has to be an element of time-restricting feeding for some people with some conditions. So if someone has been told by their doctor, for example, that they have excess fat in their liver, I often say, okay, well, what might be a healthy approach for you is if we close the kitchen at 7 p.m. and we have that time to fast overnight, but it's not to fast, it's just to allow your body do other jobs. Because when your body is constantly digesting and absorbing and metabolizing food, it has another to-do list that it needs to get to. So it's actually just creating extra stress on your body in terms of not having enough time to do everything. When it comes to fasting where it's days or there's water fasts these days or juice fasts, where water fasts is where people aren't consuming water and that's highly dangerous and you could die. So I'm not going to sit here and say that's a good idea. It's not smart at all. Juice fasts aren't great either. People do it thinking that they're going to give their body a rest, but actually what they're doing is just plying their body with sugar all day long and not enough protein, not enough fiber, not enough of all the other important things. And their body's going to suffer as a result. It's not a good idea. It's not something I would advocate. And every dentist would back me up. Every dentist hates the juice fast too. There's other concepts such as 5-2, where you just eat a significantly less, maybe only 500 calories on one or two days of the week. I'm not a huge fan of that. There are circumstances where I've seen it and it has been a game changer for some people. That said, if you're a parent and you're doing that around small kids, I would say that that's not something I would advocate for. I would say that you are potentially triggering an eating disorder in your kids because you're teaching them you need to not eat. And I think that's a really destructive message. And, you know, it's really unhealthy. And if there's a parent listening, I'm sorry, I don't agree with you. I don't care how much it's benefiting you. It's not benefiting them. Then there's other things like 16-8. And 16-8 is where you're not eating for 16 hours of the day and you are eating for 8 hours. And there's two things there. One, when is the 8 hour window? So some people go, I'm going to do it. And what they interpret it as is skipping breakfast. But actually, if you are doing the 16-8, I would say that it would be preferable to have that 8 hour window between 9 to 5 or between daylight hours. So in line with your circadian rhythm, in line with when your body wants to be fed. Good nutrition is about giving your body what it needs when it needs it. So I would be like, okay, that's fine. But we have no evidence to say 16-8 is better than 18-10, which is better than, another ratio of numbers. So again, it goes back to the time restrictive feeding. Maybe you just need to close the kitchen at a certain time in the evening time.
And let's face it, if we're in the kitchen after 7 o'clock at night, we're not in there having a salad, are we?
No, we need to not hang out in the kitchen. We need to go preferably into another room.
What about the elimination of particular food groups? That's another one, another fad that is doing the rounds lately, where somebody just eats a diet that has zero to virtually no carbs, for example.
Yeah. And again, I would say to that person, okay, well, what feeds your brain? And they go, I don't know. And I'm like, well, it's carbohydrate. And your brain needs the equivalent of around 8 slices of bread a day just to feed itself. And wow, the brain doesn't like feeding on anything else. And then I go to the person, what are you focused on? And they're eating lots and lots of protein. I would explain to them, do you know that your body's probably turning some of that protein you are eating into carbohydrate? It can do that. And they go, no, I don't realize I was doing that. And I go, okay, well, would it not be better just to eat the carbohydrate and get all the fiber and B vitamins and antioxidants and polyphenols and all the other wonderful things within whole grain carbohydrate into your diet, as well as the protein, if your body's just turning the protein into carbohydrate anyway? So I find that most people who are doing keto are doing it wrong. And to do it right is really challenging. You would struggle to ever eat out. You would struggle to ever eat in a sociable way. So therefore, is it affecting your social health? Nearly always. And is there an easier way to do things? So when it comes to cutting out food groups, I think that it's nearly never sustainable. And when people understand the biochemistry, the physiology, the science behind it, they realize what they're trying to achieve isn't actually being achieved. And there's another way to do it.
So let's talk about where the science does lead us then, and what is the ideal way to eat?
Well, this is really annoying for people to hear, but it is actually, we've been right for a long, long time. There are small mistakes that we made, but we have been saying the same thing for a long, long time. And I appreciate that it's boring to people that we need our perfect meal has whole grain carbohydrates, proteins, fats, fruit and veg. The problem is that there's a lot of people trying to make money from dieting and diets at the moment. And they do that by making it sound complicated, by creating fear, and to try and focus people in on the minute details. And that pulls people away from the bigger picture and stops people achieving the bigger picture. So healthy eating isn't complicated. It's whole grain carbohydrates, protein, fats, fruit and veg at breakfast, lunch and dinner. 3 meals of equal size, not a small breakfast, medium lunch and a large dinner. 3 meals of equal size. While you're at it, hydrate well. A couple of liters of water is a good place to start. And your body is designed to move, preferably movement that's thrown in throughout the day. And for optimal health, we do need to sleep 7 to 9 hours. But it's the same advice people said 30 years ago. You know, it's not a gimmick and you can't sell it. And therefore, people aren't making money off it. So you don't hear about it much.
Yeah, interesting. Let's get back to Christmas. Why are the weight gain and the sluggishness that we associate with Christmas? We blame Christmas. We blame Christmas Day or we blame Christmas week. But actually, it's coming from the period around the day itself.
It is. We're not sleeping as much. We're wrecked. We're really tired, but because we've been working so much to take some time off over Christmas and there's so much on. So our social lives, maybe our kids' social life. So we're really tired. We're not sleeping enough. And because we're being pulled in every direction because our social life is ramping up, it means that exercise and time for exercise has reduced. quality of food is off. So we're not getting 3 healthy meals a day. We're probably not well hydrated. There might be extra alcohol. So all of these things are not good practices and make us feel pretty poxy. You know, even just storing that extra carbohydrate and water weight in your body won't make us feel great about ourselves. And that will also be storing extra water because of extra salt and things. So all in all, we feel sluggish, we feel bloated, we feel yuck. So I would say if someone wants to really enjoy Christmas, they wouldn't deprive themselves in any shape or form when they're out on the times they're socializing. But if there's 3 meals a day and 7 days a week, you're not out socializing for all 21. So I would say control what you can control. And if you eat well on all the other meals, I guarantee it will, everything will taste and feel better. So for example, if you had a chocolate bar after a salad, it will taste nicer than having a chocolate bar after a burger and chips. That's just fact. And most people would agree with that. So if you want to maximize enjoyment from all these delicious foods, I would say focus on healthy eating when you can.
Now, there are lots of magical things that happen around the Christmas period. One of the most magical to me is how you can sit there and snack and snack and snack and snack and snack and actually really have no recollection of what you've put in your gob.
Yeah. And we know that a part of that is eating distracted. So if we are watching TV and we're eating our dinner on average, we might be eating 50% more. How much more we'll be eating could be the size of our plate too. There's lots of things. So if we're maximizing enjoyment from these things, we have to be present. And I would say that's incredibly important because we don't want to bypass all the signals to our brain that we're eating. We've enjoyed it. And we're done. And when we eat in a distracted way, there's lots of signals not being sent to our brain and our body to say we've been eating. And we end up with issues with satiety. So our hunger isn't well managed and we end up eating far too much. So it's just a cycle that I encourage people to get out of simply because I want them to enjoy their chocolates. I want them to enjoy these foods that they normally don't have in the same frequency.
Some of it's just that it's hanging around as well. You know, you be overprepared. I actually made a conscious decision, very unlike me actually, but I made a conscious decision about 3 weeks ago. I'm not buying mince pies now just because I'm seeing them in the supermarket today, because I know damn well if I bring them home, they'll be eaten before Christmas and I'll have to go and buy another box. And I'll have eaten mince pies 3 weeks before I actually would have really enjoyed them.
Yeah, and I'll only buy in, for example, the chocolates that I really enjoy, because I don't want to eat chocolate in excess and the chocolate that I'm eating isn't the stuff that I really, really enjoy either. And there's, our house are full of biscuits we don't really like, chocolates we don't really like. So again,
and you feel you have to use them up if they're there.
Exactly.
You know?
Whatever you're bringing into your home, make sure it's the stuff that you absolutely love. And remember that the third chocolate doesn't taste as good as the first. So when you are buying it in, don't buy in vast quantities, because you'll eat vast quantities and that won't be as enjoyable as if you ate a few.
Now, it's not just the eating, it's the drinking as well. And we tend to do quite a lot about around Christmas. Obviously, you don't realise what you're consuming in a drink because you're maybe conscious, I won't eat as many chocolates or I'll put the biscuits away. But you'll quite happily, you know, throw a few pints down your neck or have more glasses of wine. We need to be mindful of that, don't we? What we're actually imbibing there.
Because a lot of people come into my clinic and go, Orla, I've given up bread. Right. And I go, OK. And it turns out that they're actually over consuming alcohol. Right. And I always point out, OK, a glass of wine or a pint of beer is equivalent to 2 slices of bread. And if you're going out to the pub and every 30 minutes or 60 minutes, you're going up to the bar and you're, you know, ordering another drink, that's like going up and getting another 2 slices of toast each time. So when you actually equate it to food, people realize how many calories are actually in it. And it can make a big difference to their behavior. But it's not just the calories within the alcohol itself, is that when we drink alcohol, our inhibitions for everything goes down, including food. So we snack more. We might also go to the chipper on the way home. The next day, we'll cancel the Pilates class, the exercise class. sit on the couch more, maybe even get a takeaway. It's a knock-on effect. But one of the biggest things about alcohol is that it really affects our sleep, especially the older we get. And most women, if they are listening, if they're over 35 in particular, but certainly over 45, they'll be nodding in agreement going, I just can't get away with it in the same way.
I'm nodding in agreement for anyone who might be listening. Yeah.
And when we don't sleep enough, we actually wake up the very next day with higher blood sugar levels. It's fascinating how quick our body will react in a negative way from lack of sleep. But the thing about food and the cruel thing about food, when we're not sleeping enough, we are hungrier. It takes more to fill us. We crave the less healthy stuff more and we enjoy it more too. So it really propels us to consume less healthy stuff and vast quantities of it. And all that feedback system in our body that's really great at telling us, listen, you've eaten, you've had enough, now stop. We can't hear that as well. So sleep is incredibly important and alcohol does mess it up. So I would say to people, I don't want them to not have the crack on nights out, but I would say the last drink you're having or the second or final drink you're having, does that need to be alcoholic? Could you reduce the pace? Could you drink smaller things like a bottle instead of a pint? Could you bring in 0% alcohol versions? Could you just have, if you are lacking in energy that night, a cup of coffee in one of your rounds instead? There's lots of tactical things you can do to reduce your alcohol intake so that next day you feel a lot better than what you would have.
Briefly, Orla, your top three tips at this juncture for us feeling just that little bit better maybe than we have in previous Christmases.
Breakfast and lunch are the easier ones to manage. So I would say stick to your routine as much as possible. Do make sure if you're going out to dinner, you're not going out starving, because if you're going out starving, you're less likely to make a healthy choice. So have a bit of a snack before you go out. Watch the alcohol intake. You know, do something that means that you can still have fun, you can still enjoy it, but it's not affecting your sleep, it's not affecting your next day, it's not having a terrible knock-on effect. With alcohol, set yourself some guidelines this Christmas. And, you know, it's not about being puritanical, it's about feeling better so you can have as much fun as possible.
Fantastic. Orla Walsh, thanks very much for joining us and giving us your sage advice on News Talk Daily today. That's it from the podcast for today. And indeed, from me, at least for now, it's been great spending time with you here on News Talk Daily. And I hope I get to enjoy it again very soon. Sean Defoe will be here tomorrow with another edition of the podcast. But for now, from me, Tara Duggan, goodbye.